His would have incinerated me while I stood. Didn't you hear a thing I told you last night? Weren't you even listening?
I heard every word you said, I said stiffly. And for the record, I don't always wear pink. I often wear peach or lavender. You braced me for another gray man or hunter or shade. You didn't brace me for this.
How much worse could it have been?
He said disbelievingly. Much, I told him. You have no idea.
Describe it.
I did as succinctly as possible, stumbling a little over its proportions. I got nauseated all over again, merely recounting its grotesque appearance. When I finished, I said, What was it? How does it kill was what I really wanted to know. I didn't care about their names. I didn't want to see them at all. But I was developing a burgeoning obsession with the various ways I might die, especially given what the thing's intentions had seemed. I'd rather the gray man got me, or a shade. I mean, really, just hand me over to the royal hunters, please. Let them skin and stake me as Barons had said they'd once done.
No idea. Was it alone or with others?
It was alone.
Are you absolutely certain it knew you could see it? Could you be mistaken?
Oh, no. No doubt there. It touched me. I shuddered, remembering. He laughed, a hollow, humorless sound.
Funny, Miss Lane. Now, tell me what really happened.
I just did. It touched me.
Impossible,
he said.
If it had, you wouldn't be here.
I'm telling you the truth, Barons. What possible reason could I have to lie? The thing grabbed me. And I wanted desperately to scrub, especially my hands, because I'd grabbed it right back, trying to fight it off. Its skin had been reptilian, slimy, and I'd gotten much too close a look at those many convulsively sucking, revolting mouths.
And then what? Sid, oh, I'm so sorry, Miss Lane. I didn't mean to wrinkle your lovely blouse. May I press that for you? Or perhaps you gouged it with one of your pretty pink nails.
I was really beginning to wonder what his hang-up with pink was, but I didn't resent the sarcasm in his voice. I couldn't make sense of what had happened next, either, and I'd been mulling it over for nearly half an hour. It certainly hadn't been what I'd expected. Frankly, I said, it seemed strange to me, too. It grabbed me, and then it just stood there looking, well, if it had been human, I would have said confused.
Confused?
He repeated.
And Unseelie stood there looking confused, as in perplexed, confounded, baffled, consternated.
I nodded. Behind me, Fiona said, Jericho, that doesn't make any sense.
I know, Fio.
Baron's tone changed when he addressed her, softened noticeably. It was sharp as a knife when he resumed his interrogation of me.
So it looked confused. Then what, Miss Lane?
I shrugged. While the thing had stood there looking stymied, finally, finally, a little steel had kicked in. I punched it in the gut and ran. It chased me, but not right away. I think it stood there a minute, long enough that I was able to flag down a taxi and get away. I made the cabbie drive around for a while, to make sure I'd lost it. Also to try to muddle through what had just happened. I'd been grabbed by death, but granted a reprieve, and I had no idea why. I'd been able to think of only one person who might. Then I came to you.
At least you did one thing right and muddied your path here,
he muttered. He stepped closer, peering down at me as if I were some strange new species he'd never seen before.
What the bloody hell are you, Miss Lane?
I don't know what you mean. You don't even know what you are, Alina had said in her message. If you can't keep your head down and honor your bloodline, go die somewhere else, the old woman in the bar had hissed. And now Barons was demanding to know what I was. I tend bar. I like music. My sister was murdered recently. I seem to have gone insane since then. I added this last almost conversationally. He glanced beyond me, at Fiona.
See if you can uncover any record, however obscure, of this kind of thing happening.
You don't need me to do that, Jericho, she said. You know there is. He shook his head.
She couldn't possibly be a null, Fio. They're mythical.
Fiona's laugh was airy, musical.
So you say. As are many things, aren't they, Jericho?
What's a null? I said.
Barons ignored my question.
Describe this unseelie for Fiona again, Miss Lane, in as much detail as you can. She may be able to identify it.
To Fiona, he said,
after the two of you have finished here, show Miss Lane to her room. Tomorrow, purchase shears and buy an assortment of hair colors for her to choose from.
A room? Fiona exclaimed.
Shears? Hair colors? I exclaimed. My hands flew to my hair. I'd address the room part in a minute. I had my priorities.
Can't bear to shed your pretty feathers, Miss Lane. What did you expect? It knows you saw it. It won't stop looking for you until you're dead, or it is. And believe me, they don't die easily, if at all. The only question is whether it will alert the hunters or come for you by itself. If you're lucky, it's one of a kind like the Grey Man. The lower castes prefer to hunt alone.
You mean, maybe it won't tell any of the other Unseelie? I felt a small surge of hope. One Unseelie might just be survivable, but the thought of being hunted by a multitude of monsters was enough to make me give up without even trying. I could too easily envision a horde of hideous creatures chasing me through the Dublin night. I'd keel over and die of a heart attack before they ever caught me.
They have as many factions among themselves as humans do, he said. The Fae, particularly the Unseelie, trust each other about as much as you might trust sharing a cage with a hungry lion.
Or a Jericho Baron's, I was thinking a quarter hour later, when Fiona showed me to a room. That's exactly what it felt like, preparing to spend the night at Baron's Books and Baubles, like I was taking up residence in the lion's den. Out of the frying pan, into the fire. That was me. But I'd thought twice about pitching a fit, because if my choices were staying at the inn by myself or staying here, I'd rather stay here, if only to minimize my odds of dying alone and unnoticed for several days like my sister had. The bookstore extended farther back from the street than I'd realized. The rear half wasn't part of the store at all, but living quarters. Fiona briskly unlocked one door, led me down a short corridor, then unlocked a second door, and we entered Baron's private residence. I got a fleeting impression of understated wealth as she whisked me through an anteroom, down a hallway, and directly to a stairwell. "Do you see them, too?" I asked, as we climbed flight after flight to the top floor.
"All myths contain a grain of truth, Miss Lane. I've handled books and artifacts that will never find their way into a museum or library, things no archaeologist or historian could ever make sense of. There are many realities pocketed away in the one we call our own. Most go blindly about their lives and never see beyond the ends of their noses. Some of us do."
Which told me nothing about her, really, but she hadn't exactly been giving off warm and friendly vibes in my direction, so I didn't press. After Baron's left, I'd described the thing again. She had taken notes with brusque efficiency, rarely looking at me directly. She had gotten the same tight-lipped look my mom got when she vigorously disapproved of something. I was pretty sure the something was me, but couldn't imagine why. We stopped at a door at the end of the hall.
"Here."
Fiona thrust a key into my hand, then turned back for the stairwell.
"Oh, and Miss Lane,"
she said over her shoulder,
"I'd lock myself in if I were you."
It was advice I hadn't needed. I wedged a chair beneath the door handle, too. I would have barricaded it with the dresser as well, but it was too heavy for me to move. The rear bedroom windows looked down four stories onto an alley behind the bookstore. The alley vanished into darkness on the left and semi-darkness on the right, after bisecting narrow, cobbled walkways that ran along each side of the building. Across the alley was a one-story structure that looked like a warehouse or a huge garage with glass-block windows that were painted black, making it impossible to discern anything within. Floodlights washed the area directly between the buildings white, illuminating a walkway from door to door. Dublin sprawled beneath me, a sea of roofs, melting into the night sky. To my left, so few lights pierced the darkness that it appeared that section of the city was dead. I was relieved to see there was no fire escape on the rear of the building. I didn't think any of the unseelie I'd seen could scale the sheer brick face. I refused to dwell on the winged hunters. I double-checked all the locks and closed the drapes. Then I dug my brush from my purse, sat down on the bed, and began brushing my hair. I worked on it for a long time until it shimmered like blonde silk. I was going to miss it. "Don't leave the bookstore until I return," read the note that had been shoved beneath my door sometime during the night. I crumpled it, irritated. What was I supposed to eat? It was 10 o'clock. I had slept late and was starving. I'm one of those people that needs to eat as soon as I wake up. I removed the chair from beneath the knob and unlocked the door. Though my proper southern upbringing made me balk at the idea of intruding into another person's house without an invitation to make myself at home, I didn't see that I had any choice but to go hunting for his kitchen. I would get a sick headache if I went too long without food. Mom says it's because my metabolism is so high. When I opened the door, I discovered someone had been busy while I'd slept. A bakery bag, a bottled latte, and my luggage were outside the door. Down south, store-bought food outside your bedroom door isn't a treat, it's an insult. Despite the presence of my personal belongings, Behrens couldn't have told me any more plainly not to make myself at home. "Stay out of my kitchen," the bag said, "and don't go looking around." Down south, it meant. Leave before lunch, preferably now. I ate 2 croissants, drank the coffee, got dressed, and retraced my steps of last night directly back to the bookstore. I didn't look either way as I went. Any curiosity I might have felt about Behrens was second to my pride. He didn't want me there? Fine. I didn't want to be there. In fact, I wasn't sure why I was there. I mean, I knew why I had stayed, but I had no idea why he had let me. I wasn't stupid enough to think Jericho Behrens had an ounce of chivalry in him. Damsels in distress were clearly not his cup of tea. "Why are you helping me?" I asked him that night, when he returned to the store. I wondered where he'd been. I was still where I'd spent the entire day, in the rear conversation area of the store, the one that was almost out of sight, back by the bathroom and set of doors that led to Behrens's private quarters. I'd pretended to be reading while I was really trying to make sense of my life and contemplating the various hair color shades Fiona had brought when she'd arrived to open the store at noon. She'd ignored my efforts to make conversation and hadn't spoken to me all day except for the offer of a sandwich at lunch. At 8:10, she had locked up the store and left. A few minutes later, Behrens had appeared. He dropped into a chair across from me, elegance and arrogance in tailored black pants, black boots, and a white silk shirt he'd not bothered to tuck in. The snowy fabric contrasted with his coloring, intensifying his slicked-back hair to midnight, his eyes to obsidian, his skin to bronze. He'd rolled the sleeves back at his wrists. One powerful forearm sported a platinum and diamond watch, the other an embossed wide silver cuff that looked very old and Celtic. Tall, dark, and basely sexual, in a way I suppose some women might find irresistibly attractive, Behrens exuded his usual unsettling vitality. "I'm not helping you, Miss Lane. I'm entertaining the notion that you might be of use to me. If so, I need you alive."
"How could I be of use to you?"
"I want the Shisadu."
So did I, but I didn't see how my odds of getting it were any greater than his. In fact, in light of recent events, I didn't see that I had any odds of getting the darn thing at all. What could he need me for?
You think I can help find it somehow?
Perhaps. Why haven't you altered your appearance yet, Miss Lane? Didn't Fiona provide you with the necessary items?
I was thinking maybe I could wear a ball cap. His gaze flicked from my face to my feet and back again, in a way that said he'd taken my measure and found me seriously lacking. I could tuck it up and pull the bill down really low, I said. I've done it before, back home on bad hair days. With sunglasses on, you can hardly see me at all. He folded his arms across his chest. It could work, I said defensively. He shook his head once, just a few inches to the left and back.
When you've finished cutting and coloring your hair, return to me. Short and dark, Miss Lane. Lose the Barbie look.
I didn't cry when I did it. I did, however. Damn Jericho Barons for doing what he did to me next. Throw up all over his Persian rug in the back of the bookstore when I came back down. Looking back, I realized I began to feel it while I was upstairs washing my hair in the bathroom that adjoined my room. A wave of sudden nausea washed over me, but I thought it was an emotional reaction to changing my appearance so drastically. I'd already begun to wonder who I was and what was wrong with me. Now I was going to look wrong, too. The feeling intensified as I descended the stairs and grew stronger as I made my way back to the bookstore. I should have paid more attention to it, but I was feeling sorry for myself to the point of obliviousness. By the time I stepped through the second of the doors that separated Barron's personal and professional domains, I was shivering and sweating at the same time. My hands were clammy, and my stomach was a churning mess. I'd never gone from feeling fine to feeling awful so quickly in my life. Barron's was seated on the sofa I'd vacated, his arms stretched across the back of it, his legs spread, looking relaxed as a lion lazing after the kill. His gaze, however, was sharp as a hawk's. He studied me with voracious interest as I stepped through the door. There were some papers on the sofa next to him that I had yet to understand the significance of. I closed the door and promptly doubled over and vomited what was left of my lunch. Most of the damage to his precious rug was water I'd drunk. I'm big on drinking lots of water. Hydrating one's skin from the inside out is even more important than using a good moisturizer on the surface. I heaved until there was nothing left, then I retched a few times more. I was on my hands and knees again for the second time in as many days, and I didn't like it a bit. I dragged my sleeve across my mouth and glared up at him. I hated my hair, and I hated my life, and I could feel it blazing in my eyes. He, on the other hand, looked pleased as punch. "What just happened, Barron's? What did you do to me?" I accused. Improbable though it seemed, I was certain that somehow he'd had everything to do with my sudden malaise. He laughed and stood up, looking down at me.
"You, Miss Lane, can sense the she's ado, and you just became very, very useful to me."
11. "I don't want it," I repeated, backing away. "Get it away from me."
"It won't harm you, Miss Lane, at least not in this form,"
Barron said again. I didn't believe what he was saying the fifth time any more than I had the first. I flung an arm behind me, at the rug still damp from my cleaning efforts. "What do you call that? If I had anything left in my stomach at all, I'd still be on my hands and knees. I don't know about you, but I call impromptu vomiting harm." Not to mention the deep sense of dread I still couldn't shake. The fine hair on my body was standing on end as if I'd been hit with a high-voltage charge. I wanted to put as much distance between it and me as was possible.
"You'll get used to it."
"So you keep saying," I muttered.
"And your reactions will lessen in time."
I have no intention of spending that much time around it. It was photocopies of two pages allegedly ripped from the She Sedu. Photocopies, not even the real thing, he was thrusting at me. Mere facsimiles had me plastered up against the wall in my frantic efforts to avoid it. I could feel a spidey moment coming on. If he didn't back off, I was going to scale the walls using only my gentleman prefer blonde's blush nails as repelling spikes, and I seriously doubted it was going to work.
Take slow, deep breaths,
Baron said.
You can overcome it. Concentrate, Miss Lane.
I gulped air. It didn't help.
I said breathe, not do a fish-out-of-water imitation.
I looked at him coldly, inhaled, and held it. After a long moment, Barons nodded, and I exhaled slowly.
Better,
he said. Why is this happening to me? I asked.
It's part of being what you are, Miss Lane. Thousands of years ago, when the Fae still ran the wild hunt, destroying anything in their path, this was what a she-seer felt when the Tuatha-De riders approached in mass. This was her warning to lead her people to safety.
I didn't feel it when I saw any of the Unseelie, I pointed out. But as I reflected on those first two times, I realized I had gotten queasy, and both times a general, inexplicable sense of dread had preceded my visions. I just not recognized it for what it was because I'd not been able to pin it on anything. With the last monster, I'd been so obsessed with getting to Alina's, and I'd crashed into it so fast that I couldn't decide whether I'd felt anything in advance or not.
I said, in mass,
he said,
alone or in pair, their impact is not as great. It is possible only the Shisadu will ever make you this sick, or perhaps a thousand Unseelie bearing down on you. The Dark Book is the most powerful of all the Fae Hallows, as well as the deadliest.
Stay back, I snapped. He closed less than a yard from me, holding those terrible pages. He took another step forward, and I tried to make myself into wallpaper, very yellow, very spineless wallpaper.
Master your fear, Miss Lane. They are mere copies of the real pages. Only pages of the Dark Book itself could do you lasting harm.
They could? That certainly put a problematic spin on things. You mean even if we manage to find this book, I'm not going to be able to touch it? His lips curved, but his eyes stayed cold.
You could. I'm not certain you would like yourself afterward.
Why wouldn't I broke off, shaking my head. Forget it. I don't want to know. Just keep those pages away from me.
Does this mean you're giving up the quest to find your sister's murderer, Miss Lane? I thought she begged you to find the Shisadu. I thought she said everything depended on it.
I closed my eyes and sagged back against the wall. For a few minutes there, I'd completely forgotten about Alina. Why? I whispered, as if she were still there to hear. Why didn't you tell me any of this? We could have helped each other. Maybe we could have kept each other alive. And that was the bitterest part of all, how things might have turned out, if only she'd confided in me.
I doubt you would have believed, even if she had. You've been a tough sell, Miss Lane. As much as you've seen and heard, you're still trying to deny it.
This is the end of disc number 3. Please continue listening on disc number 4. This is disc number 4.
You've been a tough sell, Miss Lane,
Baron said.
As much as you've seen and heard, you're still trying to deny it.
His voice was much too close. Barons had moved. I opened my eyes. He was standing right in front of me, yet my sickness hadn't intensified because I hadn't seen him coming. He was right. My reaction was as much mental as it was physical, which meant at least part of it was controllable. I could retreat, go home, and try to forget everything that had happened to me since I'd arrived in Dublin, or I could figure out how to go forward. I touched my short, dark locks. I hadn't butchered my beautiful blonde hair for nothing. You see the Fae too, Barons, yet you have no problem holding those pages. Repetition dulls even the keenest senses, Miss Lane. Are you ready to begin? 2 hours later, Behrens decided I'd had enough practice. I couldn't bring myself to touch the photocopied pages, but at least I was no longer retching in close proximity to them. I'd figured out a way to close my throat off against the involuntary heaves. Nearness still made me feel perfectly miserable, but I could muster and maintain a presentable mask.
You'll do. Get dressed. We're going somewhere.
I am dressed. He turned toward the front of the store and looked out the window at the night.
Go put on something more grown-up, Miss Lane.
Huh? I had on white capris, dainty sandals, and a sleeveless pink blouse over a lace-trimmed tank. I thought I looked perfectly grown up. I circled around in front of him. What's wrong with me? He gave me a brief glance.
Go put on something more womanly.
With my figure, nobody could ever accuse me of not being womanly. Understanding might come slowly to me sometimes, but it comes. Men. Take them into a classy lingerie store, and I guarantee you they'll find the only thing in there made of cheap black leather and chains. My eyes narrowed. You mean sleazy, I said.
I mean the kind of woman others are accustomed to seeing me with. A grown one, if you think you can manage that, Miss Lane. Black might make you look old enough to drive. The new hair is better. But do something with it. Make it look like it did the night I woke you.
You want me to have bedhead on purpose?
If that's what you call it. Will an hour be enough?
An hour implied that I needed a lot of help. I'll see what I can do, I said coolly. I was ready in 20 minutes. My suspicions about the building behind the bookstore were confirmed. It was a garage, and Jericho Behrens was a very rich man. I guess the books and baubles trade was pretty darned lucrative. From the eye-popping collection of cars in his garage, he chose a modest by comparison black Porsche 911 Turbo that roared deep in its masterfully engineered 515-horsepower throat when he slid the key into the ignition on the wrong side of the steering wheel and turned it. Yes, I know cars. I love fast, pretty ones, and the subtle class of the pricey Porsche appealed to every shallow bone in my 22-year-old body. He put the top down and drove much too fast, but with the expert aggressiveness any high-performance vehicle capable of running 0 to 60 in 3.6 seconds demanded. One neighborhood melted into the next as he worked the engine, shifting up and down through the stop-and-go traffic of the city. Once past the outskirts of Dublin, he opened it up. Beneath a nearly full moon, we raced the wind. The air was warm, the sky brilliant with stars, and under other circumstances, I would have tremendously enjoyed the ride. I glanced over at him. Whatever else he might be, obviously a she-seer himself and a royal pain in the ass most of the time, Behrens was now just a man, lost in the pleasure of the moment, of the finely crafted machine in his hands, of the wide-open road and the seemingly limitless night. "Where are we going?" I had to shout to make myself heard over the dual roar of the wind and engine. Without taking his eyes off the road, for which I was eminently grateful at 104 miles an hour, he said,
"There are 3 main players in the city that have also been searching for the book. I want to know if they've found anything. You, Miss Lane, are my bloodhound,"
he shouted back. I glanced at the clock on the dash. "It's 2 in the morning, Behrens. What are we going to do, break and enter and creep around in their houses while they're sleeping?" It was a measure of how surrealistic my life had become that, if he replied in the affirmative, I suspected the first thing out of my mouth wouldn't be a protest but a complaint that he'd made me get overdressed for burgling. High heels and a short skirt would certainly make running from the police or angry armed property owners very difficult. He slowed a little so I could hear him better.
"No, they're night people, Miss Lane. They'll be up and just as willing to see me as I am to see them. We like to keep tabs on one another. They, however, don't have you."
A slow smile curved his lips. He was hugely pleased with the new secret weapon he had in me. I had a sudden dismal view of my future, of being led around and asked incessantly, like one of those Verizon commercials, "Do you feel sick now?" He sped up, and we drove another 10 minutes or so in silence, then turned off the main road into the entrance of a walled estate. After being cleared by a pair of coldly efficient white-uniformed security guards, who, after a quiet phone call, retracted an enormous steel gate, we purred down a long, winding drive framed on both sides by huge ancient trees. The house at the end of the drive was anachronistic to its setting, which seemed to suggest a stately manor house had once stood there but had been razed to be replaced with this sprawling, chilly, brilliantly spotlighted Meet the Jetsons affair of steel and glass. See-through skywalks connected 5 levels that slanted at slight upward angles, and metal-framed terraces sported new-age furniture that looked positively miserable to sit in. I admit it, I'm old-fashioned. Give me a wraparound porch with white wicker furniture, swings on each end, slow-paddling ceiling fans, ivy-covered trellises, and hanging baskets of ferns, all beneath the shade of waxy-blossomed magnolia trees. This place was way too artsy and not nearly homey enough for me. As we got out of the car, Baron said, "Keep your wits about you and try not to touch anything that doesn't look human, Miss Lane." I nearly choked on a nervous laugh. Whatever had happened to good old wholesome advice like, "Stick together, hold hands, and look both ways before you cross the street"? I glanced up at him. Not that I would want to, but why shouldn't I?
"I suspect Fiona is right, and you are a null, which means you'll give us away if you touch any of the Fae with your hands."
I looked at my hands, at the pretty pink nails that didn't complement my new look so well. My darker dew would be better accented by slightly bolder tones. I would need to implement some wardrobe and accessorizing changes. "A null?" I had to work to keep up with him in my heels as we hurried across the shimmering white-crushed quartz drive.
"Old legends speak of she-seers with the ability to freeze a fae by touching it with their hands, immobilizing it for several minutes, preventing it from moving or even sifting place."
"Sifting place?"
"Later. Do you remember what to do, Miss Lane?"
I eyed the house. It looked like there was a party going on. People milled on the terraces, laughter, music, and the clink of ice in glasses floated down to where we stood. "Yes, if I start to feel sick, I should ask to use the bathroom. You'll escort me to it."
"Very good. And Miss Lane?"
I glanced at him questioningly.
"Try to act like you like me."
When he put his arm around me and pulled me close, the shiver went clear down to my toes. The house was decorated in unrelieved white and black. The people were, too. If it were up to me, I would carry a great big paintbrush around with me all the time, splashing color everywhere, decorating the world with peach and mauve, pink and lavender, orange and aquamarine. These folks seemed to think leeching the world of all color was cool. I decided they all must be deeply depressed. Jericho. A stunning raven-haired woman in a low-cut white evening gown and diamonds purred throatily. But her smile was teeth and viciousness, and for me, not him. "I almost didn't recognize you. I'm not sure we've ever seen each other with our clothes on."
"Marilyn?"
He acknowledged her with a brief nod that seemed to piss her off royally as we passed.
"Who's your little friend, Barons?"
A tall, anorexically thin man with a frightful shock of white hair asked. I wanted to pull him aside and give him the gentle advice that wearing all black only made him look thinner and sicker, but I didn't think now was a good time.
"None of your fucking business,"
Baron said.
"Ah, we are in our usual fine form, aren't we?"
the man sneered.
"We implies we came from the same gene pool, Ellis. We didn't. Arrogant fuck,"
the man muttered to our backs. "I see you've got a lot of friends here," I remarked dryly.
"No one has friends in this house, Miss Lane. There are only users, and the used at Casablanca."
"Except for me," I said. "Weird name for a weirder house." He gave me a cursory glance.
"You'll learn. if you live long enough.
Even if I lived to be 90, I would never become like the people in this house. The murmured acknowledgments continued as we passed through the rooms, some hungry, mostly from the women, and others damning, mostly from the men. It was an awful bunch of people. I suffered a sudden stab of homesickness, missed my mom and dad with a vengeance. I didn't see anything that wasn't human until we came to that last room at the far end of the house on the fifth floor. We had to pass through three sets of armed security guards to get there. Reality check. I was at a party with armed security guards, and I was wearing all black. It couldn't be my reality. I wasn't that kind of person. Sadly, despite the short skirt that bared my pretty tanned legs to well above mid-thigh, a snug, bosom-enhancing top and high heels, compared to the rest of the women at Casablanca, I looked 15. I thought I'd turned my shoulder-length dark hair into something wild and sexy, but I obviously didn't know the meaning of those words, nor did I understand a thing about the artful application of makeup.
"Stop fidgeting," Baron said.
I took a deep breath and held it for a three count. Next time, a little more detail on our intended destination might help.
"Take a good look around, Miss Lane, and next time you won't need it."
We stepped through a pair of enormous white doors into a large white-upon-white room. White walls, white carpet, white glassed-in cases interspersed with white columns upon which priceless objet d'art rested. I stiffened, confronted with double visions. Now that I knew such monsters existed, it was easier to spot them. I decided these two couldn't be putting much effort into the glamour they were throwing, or else I was getting better at penetrating it, because once I saw past their beefy blonde bouncer projections, they didn't flicker between the two but remained unseely.
"Easy,"
Barons murmured, sensing my tension. To the man seated on the absurd white throne-like chair in front of us, as if holding audience for his subjects, he said in a bored voice,
"McCabe, Barons!"
I don't generally like big-boned, hard-bodied, auburn-haired men, and I was surprised to find McCabe attractive in a rough-hewn Irish way that would never polish up, no matter the wealth he managed to accumulate or the treasures with which he chose to surround himself. But the two unseely flanking him, left and right, weren't attractive at all. They were huge, ugly, gray-skinned things that reminded me of rhinoceroses with their bumpy, oversized foreheads, tiny eyes, jutting underbites, and lipless gashes for mouths. Wide, squat, barrel-like bodies strained at the seams of ill-fitting white suits. Their arms and legs were stumpy, and they were making a constant deep-in-the-throat snuffling sound, like pigs rooting through the mud for whatever it was pigs rooted. They weren't scary. They were just ugly. I focused on not focusing on them. Aside from mild heartburn and a sense of increased agitation, they hardly made me feel sick at all. Of course, any phase impact would now and forever be diminished in the dark shadow of the Shisadu.
"What brings you to Casablanca?"
McCabe said, adjusting the white tie on the white shirt beneath the jacket of his white suit. Why bother? I couldn't help but think. Ties fell into the accessory category, and the very definition of accessorizing was accenting or enhancing by artful arrangement of color, texture, and style. Hello? Had anyone heard the word color in there? He might just as well have painted himself white. Baron shrugged.
"Nice night for a drive." "Almost a full moon, Barons. Things can get dangerous out there." "Things can get dangerous anywhere, McCabe."
McCabe laughed, showing movie star white teeth. He looked me over.
"Into something a little different, Barons. Who's the little girl?"
"Don't speak," Barons had told me on the way there. "No matter what anyone says, I don't care how pissed off you might get, swallow it." His derisive little girl ringing in my ears, I bit down hard and didn't say a word.
"Just the latest piece of ass, McCabe."
I no longer had to bite down. I was speechless. McCabe laughed.
"She talk?" "Not unless I tell her to. Her mouth's usually too full.
I could feel my cheeks burning. McCabe laughed again.
When she grows up, pass her my way, will ya?
He looked me over thoroughly, ice-blue eyes lingering on my bosom and bottom, and by the time he was done, I felt as if he'd not only seen me nude, but somehow knew I had a tiny heart-shaped mole on the left cheek of my behind, and another on my right breast, just east of my nipple. His expression changed, his nostrils widened, his eyes narrowed.
On second thought,
he murmured,
don't let her grow up too much. What would you take for her now?
Barron's flashed a mocking smile.
There's a book I might be interested in.
McCabe snorted, brought the tip of his index finger to his thumb, and flicked an imaginary speck of lint from his sleeve.
No bitch is that good. There are women, and there's power, and only one of those holds its value.
His expression changed again. His lips thinned out, and his eyes went chillingly empty. Just like that, McCabe lost interest in me, and I had the startling realization that to him, I wasn't even human. I was more like, well, a condom, something he'd use, then toss the soiled remains away from his person. And if we happened to be in a speeding car on the Autobahn or a jet crossing the Atlantic at the time, so what? Had Alina been in this world? Had she known this obsessive-compulsive man in white? I could certainly see him killing her, or killing anyone, for that matter. But could I see Alina believing herself in love with a man like him? Granted, he was rich, worldly, and attractive in a brutish, powerful way. But the inspector and the two girls I'd spoken with had been absolutely certain Alina's boyfriend wasn't native to the Emerald Isle, and McCabe, despite his enormous pretensions, was salt-of-the-earth Irish through and through.
Heard anything about it?
Barron's lost interest in me, too, and moved on to a new subject. Simply two men going about their business, with walking, talking, or rather mute, sex on heels nearby in case anyone wanted any, just a convenient platter of oyster on the half-shell.
No,
McCabe said flatly.
You? No,
Barron's replied just as flatly. McCabe nodded.
Well, then, leave her and go, or just leave.
It was obvious he couldn't have cared less which option Barron's chose to exercise. In fact, if I had gotten left, I wasn't sure McCabe would even notice me again for several days. The King of White had dismissed us. 12. Glamour. Illusion cast by the Fae to camouflage their true appearance. The more powerful the Fae, the more difficult it is to penetrate its disguise. The average human sees only what the Fae wants them to see, and is subtly repelled from bumping into or brushing against it by a small perimeter of spatial distortion that is part of the Fae glamour. And that was why the monster in the alley with mule-sized genitals and leech-like sucking mouths had instantly known what I was. I had been unable to avoid crashing into it. Any other person would have been repelled the instant they'd rounded the corner and stumbled clumsily, careening off nothing they could see. You know all those times you say, "Geez, I don't know what's wrong with me. I must have tripped over my own feet." Think again. According to Barron's, McCabe had no idea his bodyguards were unseelie who'd addressed each other as Ob and Erg when they'd escorted us from the throne room in guttural tones Barron's and I pretended not to hear. McCabe's usual staff of bodyguards had disappeared 3 months ago and been replaced by the Rhino Boys, a type of unseelie Barron's believed were low-to-mid-level caste thugs dispatched primarily as watchdogs for the highest-ranking Fae. After thinking about that for a minute and following it to the logical conclusion, I had said, "Does that mean an unseelie is hunting for the Shisadu, too?"
"It looks that way,"
Barron's replied.
"And a very powerful one, at that. I keep catching wind of someone the Unseelie called the Lord Master, but so far I've had no luck discovering who or what this Lord Master is. I told you, Miss Lane, that you had no idea what you were getting into."
The Unseelie were terrifying enough. I had no desire to encounter whatever they addressed as their ruler. Well, maybe now's a real good time for me to get right back out of it, I'd said. Try, the look he'd given me had said. Even if I managed to close my heart and turn my back on my sister's murder, Jericho Behrens wasn't about to let me go. Sad fact was, we needed each other. I could sense the Shisadu, and he had all the pertinent information about it, including a few ideas about where it might be and who else was looking for it. Left to my own devices, I would never be able to find out about parties like the one at Casa Blanc and get myself invited there. Left to his own devices, Behrens would never know if the book was nearby, perhaps even in the same room with him. He could be standing right next to it for all he knew. I had gotten a good idea just how important I was to him last night. If the book was metal, I was Jericho Behrens' own private state-of-the-art metal detector. After Ab and Erg had returned to McCabe, Behrens had escorted me through floor after floor of the starkly decorated house. When I'd felt nothing, he'd marched me all over the manicured estate, including the outbuildings. He'd insisted we cover the ground so thoroughly that I hadn't gotten back to my borrowed bedroom to sleep until just before dawn. Reluctant though I was to feel something so awful again, I'd been almost disappointed when my newly discovered spidey sense hadn't picked up the faintest tingle anywhere. Still, to me, the bottom line wasn't about the dark book at all. It was about uncovering the details of my sister's secret life. I didn't want the creepy thing. I just wanted to know who or what had killed Alina, and I wanted him or it dead. Then I wanted to go home to my pleasantly provincial podunk little town in steamy southern Georgia and forget about everything that had happened to me while I was in Dublin. The Fae didn't visit Ashford? Good. I'd marry a local boy with a jacked-up Chevy pickup truck, Toby Keith singing Who's Your Daddy on the radio, and 8 proud generations of honest, hard-working Ashford ancestors decorating his family tree. Short of essential shopping trips to Atlanta, I'd never leave home again. But for now, working with Behrens was my only option. The people I met during our search could be people Alina had met, too. And if I could somehow find and retrace the path she'd taken through this bizarre film noir world, it should lead me straight to her killer. I would be seriously rethinking the wisdom of that before long. I picked up my pen. It was Sunday afternoon, and Behrens Books and Baubles was closed for the day. I'd woken up disoriented and badly missing Mom, but when I'd called, Dad had said she was in bed and he didn't want to wake her. She hadn't been sleeping well, he said, even though she'd been taking something that was supposed to help her. I'd carried on an achingly one-sided conversation with him for a few minutes, but his efforts had been so painfully half-hearted that I'd given up. At a loss for what to do, I'd finally grabbed my journal and gone downstairs to the bookstore. Now I was sprawled on my stomach on the comfy sofa in the rear conversation area of the bookstore, notebook propped on a pillow in front of me. Sifting, a method of Fae locomotion, I wrote. I nibbled the tip of my fine-point felt-tipped fuchsia pen and tried to figure out how to write this one down. When Behrens had explained it to me, I'd been horrified. You mean they can just think themselves somewhere and that's how instantly it happens? They just want to be someplace, and then there they are? Behrens nodded. You mean I could be walking down the street and one could just pop in alongside me and grab me?
Ah, but there you have a tremendous advantage, Miss Lane. Grab it back, and you'll freeze it like you did the one in the alley. But do it fast, before it sifts you to some place you really don't want to be.
And then what am I supposed to do? Start toting weapons around with me so I can kill them while they're frozen? No matter how horrific the Unseelie were, the thought of carving something up while it couldn't even move was abhorrent to me.
I doubt you could, Behrens said. Both Seelie and Unseelie are virtually indestructible. The higher the caste, the harder they are to kill.
Great, I said. Any ideas what I should do once I turn them into all too temporary statues?
Yes, Miss Lane,
he had replied, with that dark, sardonic smile of his.
Run like hell.
I brushed the tips of my lashes with sable mascara and wondered what one wore to visit a vampire. The chic red sweater set I'd brought with me from home not only didn't go so well with my darker hair, I was afraid it might be construed as a flirtatious invitation to color me bloodier. The dainty silver cross earrings my Aunt Sue bought me for my last birthday would no doubt be considered provocative as well. I glanced at my watch. Indecision over my outfit was making me late for my midnight appointment with Barron's. I wasn't going to have time to dash to the church down the street and dab holy water at my wrists and behind my ears. My version of, oh, de don't bite me. I stared into the mirror. I couldn't make myself look like the woman at Casablanca if I wanted to, and I didn't. I liked me. I liked my colors. I missed my hair so bad it hurt. Sighing, I turned my head upside down, hairsprayed it liberally, then set the lacquer with a blast of heat from my dryer. When I tossed it back again and finger-combed it, thanks to Ms. Clairol's medium hot rods, I had a head of shoulder-length, tousled Arabian Nights curls that framed my face seductively and made my green eyes stand out even more than they usually did. Slightly up-tilted at the outer corners, with long, dark lashes, my eyes were one of my best features, a brilliant shade of green, the color of new young grass at Easter. I have clear, even-toned skin that tans really well and goes with pretty much any shade. I didn't look bad with dark hair. I just didn't look like me. I looked older, especially with the candy apple red I'd just glossed on my mouth, a concession to Barron since I was sure he wasn't going to like the outfit I'd just decided on. As I slipped into my clothes, I remembered how Alina and I used to make fun of vampire movies and novels, and of the whole paranormal craze in general that had been launched by the creation of one small, bespectacled, pale boy who lived beneath the stairs. That was before I knew there really were things out there in the night.
"What the bloody hell do you have on, Miss Lane?"
Barron's demanded. What I had on was a luscious, gauzy skirt of nearly every pastel hue on the color wheel that hugged my hips and kicked frothily at my ankles, a form-fitting rose sweater with silk-trimmed cap sleeves and a plunging silk-edged neckline that made much of my bust, and dainty pink high heels that laced around my ankles. The colors went stunningly with my sun-kissed skin and dark curls. I looked feminine, soft, and sexy, in a wholesome young woman way, not a Casablanca way. I strode briskly past rows of bookcases to where he stood waiting impatiently by the front door of the shop, and stabbed a finger in his direction. "If you treat me like one of your skanks again tonight, Barron's, you can just forget about our little arrangement. You need me as much as I need you. That makes us equal partners in my book."
"Well, your book is just wrong,"
he said flatly. "No, yours is," I said just as flatly. "Figure out another way to explain me. I don't care what you come up with. But if you call me your latest piece of petunia again or make uncalled-for references to my mouth and oral sex with you, you and I are through." He raised a brow.
"Petunia, Miss Lane."
I scowled. "Ass, Barron's." He crossed his arms and his gaze dropped to my glossy lip-venom red lips.
"Am I to understand that are called-for references to your mouth and oral sex with me, Miss Lane? I'd like to hear them."
Eyes narrowed, I sidestepped his idiotic taunting. "Is this Malouche guy really a vampire, Barron's?" He shrugged.
"He claims to be. He is surrounded by people who believe he is."
He scanned me from head to toe.
"Last night you said you wanted to know what to expect so you could better select your attire. I told you we were going to visit a vampire in a goth den tonight. Why, then, Miss Lane, do you look like a perky rainbow?"
I shrugged in kind. "Take me or leave me, Barron's." He took me, as I'd known he would. There are a few things a hunting man can't do without. His bloodhound is one of them. McCabe lived 20 minutes to the north of the city, in my idea of a modernistic nightmare. Malouche lived 10 minutes to the south of Dublin, entombed in garish tatters of the past. The Victorian era, to be precise. Those 63 years from 1837 to 1901, during which Queen Victoria ruled Great Britain and called herself Empress of India, immortalized, erroneously perhaps, by opulent, velvet-draped, sensualistic, and often cluttered home decor. Steampunk was the theme of the night at Malouche's. Victorian-style clothing tweaked in edgy ways, ripped, distorted, and blended with goth, rivet, and punk. Although I admit sometimes I have a hard time picking up the subtle details that differentiate the individual pockets of the dark fashion world, I think you have to live in it to get it. We left the Porsche with an unseely rhino boy valet at the door, whose glamour looked like unvarnished death punk to me. In contrast, I did indeed resemble a perky rainbow. Malouche's lair was a monstrous rambling affair of brick and stone that was a mishmash of various types of Victorian architecture, leaning heavily toward Adam's Family Goth, with an embarrassment of turrets and porticos, wrought iron balustrades and battlements, oriel windows and transoms, and enough ornate cornices and brackets to dizzy the eye, not to mention baffle the soul. Four tall stories were stacked haphazardly on top of each other, cresting in a black roofline against the cobalt night sky that made no sense, but leapt whimsically from flat to dangerously steep and back again. Trees, with skeletal limbs, badly in need of a trim, scraped against slate like oaken nails on the lid of a coffin. The house rambled over an acre, and I wouldn't have been at all surprised to learn it had upward of 60 or 70 rooms. On the top floor, strobe lights flickered beyond tall, narrow windows, in tempo with raucous, driving music. On the lower floors, the ambiance was different. Black and crimson candles were the light of choice, and the music was soft, dreamy, and voluptuous. Behrens had given me a good bit of background about our soon-to-be host on the way over. Malouche had been born John Johnstone, Jr., to old British money some 30 years ago, when the senior Johnstones had died in a suspicious car accident, leaving their 24-year-old son sole heir to a several-hundred-million-dollar fortune. J.J. Jr. had turned his back on his father's vast financial empire, sold off one company after the next, and liquidated all assets. He'd cast off his embarrassingly redundant name, gotten it legally changed to the singular romantic Malouche, dressed himself in the height of refined steampunk, and presented himself to goth society as one of the newly undead. Over the years, several $100 million had bought him an extensive cult of true believers and hardcore groupies, and in some quarters, the name Malouche was nearly synonymous with Lestat. Behrens had never met him face to face, but had seen him on several occasions in the trendier nightclubs. He'd made it his business to track Malouche's interests and acquisitions.
"He goes after many of the same artifacts as I," he told me. "Last time he tried to outbid me in an exclusive internet auction. A wealthy recluse in London, Lucan Trevane, disappeared, and within days a large portion of his collection was up for grabs on the black market. I had a hacker standing by who took down Malouche's entire computer network at the crucial moment."
Dark eyes glittering, Behrens smiled, a predator relishing the memory of a cherished kill. But his smile faded as he continued.
"Unfortunately, what I'd been hoping to find in Trevane's collection was no longer there. Someone had beaten me to it. At any rate, Malouche must have learned of the Shisadu in the years preceding his father's death. The senior Johnstone dabbled in artifacts, and there was a considerable uproar in the antiquities world some time back when photocopied pages of what most believed to be a mythical, indeed, a joke of an icon, debuted on the black market. I have no idea how many photocopied sets are out there, but I do know Malouche saw the pages at some point. The undead fuck's been getting in my way ever since."
Behrens said "undead fuck" as if he strongly wished Malouche dead, not believed him undead. "You don't think he's a vampire?" I said in a hushed voice as we picked our way through room after room of stoned-looking people draped across low-backed velveteen divans, passed out in brocade chaises, and sprawled in various stages of undress on the floor. We were searching for an entrance to the sub-basement, where a dazedly compliant, slow-eyed goth girl had told us the master would be. I tried not to notice the rhythmic thrusts, grunts, and moans as I stepped carefully over half-naked tangles. Behrens laughed briefly, a hollow, humorless sound.
"If he is, The one that made him should be drowned in holy water, defanged, gelded, skinned, staked, and left to blister agonizingly in the sun.
He was silent a moment, then.
Feeling anything, Miss Lane?
I didn't think he meant embarrassment about what I'd just stepped over, so I shook my head. We passed a half a dozen more unseelie by the time we found the sub-basement, mingled in with the white-skinned, pierced and chained, black-nailed, black-lipped goth youth, casting similar noir glamours. The dark fae were doing things to their unwitting victims I refused to see, though I saw none as